I don't know if you've seen these comments yet on some of our latest YouTube videos, but I feel like I need to share these with you.
Oh, I'm excited. No, I haven't looked, so I got to hear these.
Okay. On episode 30, Carol Stewart, that was the Boston, the one about the guy who jumped off the bridge.
Yeah.
Evil Lang Builds MC 2468 wrote Fir. F-I-R.
Fir. Can we respond and be like evergreen?
Oak.
Douglas Pine.
Moving on episode 24, our Jason Sweeney case, Marks 5336 writes, PCP does dissolve in water.
And I wasn't sure. Thank you, Marks 3667394.
Thank you, Heisenberg.
I appreciate your help.
And on episode 25, the Labor Day murder, Winona Campbell 536 wrote, get to the case. The nonsense of endless chatter about issues that do not matter. Stopping listening. Googled the case. Faster results. To which I replied, good. It sounds like you were looking for a newspaper article anyway. So,
oh, my goodness.
But you know what, Melissa? Even putting out a product that she hates, we brought attention to the case. So we win.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Murder Unscripted, the true crime podcast that immerses you in the genre like never before. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along, as always, with Melissa Spivey, the beaming ray of sunlight.
That's so true. I am the sunlight of your life. It was all darkness before I came along. Or so I like to think.
If that's what you want to believe, then by all means, who am I to squash?
That's what I believe. But seriously... You're welcome for being your sunlight, because I'm over this Pennsylvania cold winter.
It's freaking awful, right? At least it's over 50 today, but man, it's been cold and windy. Light at the end of the tunnel, though, because I feel like it's getting warmer. We're turning a corner.
I hope so.
Well, we are knee-deep in March Madness, and that is our block on sports murders. And unfortunately, Melissa, I cannot bring you the warm weather, but I can bring you a story from California. So sticking with our California theme the past couple of weeks, but that's the best I can do as far as warmth.
I'll take it.
So do you want to know where in California we're going?
I do. Where are we going?
All right. So do you recognize this quote? If the glove don't fit, you must acquit.
Johnny Cochran.
From?
OJ, the murderer.
Exactly. Yep. Well, I guess it's clear where you stand on this. So.
Oh, yeah.
If you aren't as in the know as Melissa over there, I am, in fact, talking about OJ and the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman.
This case and just like the whole story of everything is so wild. Like, I was just a kid when it happened, but it was everywhere. You turn on the TV, it was there. And I feel like it was one of the first, if not the first, cases and trials that was like completely televised.
It was such a sensation. I mean, it wiped out the NBA finals were going on, and they actually went to coverage of OJ and Al Cowlings running in the white Bronco. I mean, it's crazy. And it's a story that even 30 years later, it still has movies and documentaries and books and podcasts. And the story is honestly so massive. There are just so many people involved, like household names that we've learned over the years, from lawyers to Judge Ito, to Cato Kalin. Remember him, that surfer looking guy?
Oh my goodness, yes.
Ron Goldman, the entire Brown and Goldman family, and even the town of Brentwood. I mean, it was wild.
When I think of Brentwood, I automatically think of like the Kardashians or like the Real Housewives, you know, like the easy breezy kind of life. Like you drop the kids off at school, do some shopping, have a boozy lunch with your girls. So glamorous.
You watch way too much TV if you... I think that's reality.
I definitely do. I mean, that's just the life I want to live in general.
Brentwood is a pretty amazing area. It's basically a high-end suburb of LA. And a quick peek at Zillow.com, single-family homes that are on the market today range from $4 million to $25 million. Insane.
So we're going to buy one there and one in Nantucket.
Oh, absolutely. All the money we make on this podcast.
Womp, womp.
Well, while you're house hunting, I can tell you two addresses that you will not be living at. And that is 360 Rockingham Ave and 875 South Bundy Drive. And these are the now infamous addresses where the homes of O.J. Simpson and Nicole Brown Simpson used to reside.
I didn't know about the Bundy Drive. I feel like that's just bad luck in general. Who wants to live on like Gacy Way? No, thank you.
Oh, man. Well, let's dive in. And this is going to be a little bit different take. In 1994, Orenthal James O.J. Simpson was seen as an American hero, basically a darling of the United States. His popularity started on the football field. He actually went to USC, University of Southern California, the Trojans, and won the Heisman Trophy there. So he was highly touted out of college and ended up being drafted and played 11 seasons in the NFL, mostly with the Buffalo Bills. And he was seen as one of the best running backs of all time. He was actually the first to rush for more than 2,000 yards. And that's something, not that you care, but Philadelphia's own Saquon Barkley just did this year as well. So that's it's a big deal.
Yeah, those yards. Good job, guys.
He became the league MVP, and he led the league in rushing yards and rushing touchdowns. And OJ gained the nickname Juice by fans all over the country, obviously, Orange Juice.
I just recently put that together. I thought he did steroids.
Oh, he might have.
Like, I thought he was juiced up. Like, that's why I thought.
Orange
I was
juice.
Like, what is happening? Okay, that makes more sense.
So after football retirement, OJ's popularity landed him deals to do commentary. He did commercials for Hertz Rental Company. He even jumped into acting and landed a ton of roles in TV shows. And most people probably remember him most for playing the character Nordberg in all the Naked Gun movies with Leslie Nielsen. Do you remember those?
No, I've never seen those. Oh,
God, they're so funny. All right, well, this is before your time then.
Exactly. This is all before my time.
Well, then you're going to learn something. So OJ had married his first wife, Marguerite, in 1967, and the couple had three children, Arnell, Jason, and Aaron, who sadly passed away in 1979 at only 2 years old in a drowning accident. So here's the thing. OJ met and started dating Nicole Brown in 1977, though, while he was still married to Marguerite and while she was pregnant with Aaron. And in some of the documentaries I've seen, I'm drawing a blank on which one in particular, but I believe it was one of the Netflix ones. He said OJ didn't even want Marguerite to continue the pregnancy. So I think it's safe to say that he was kind of checked out of his marriage, because at 30 years old, he started a new life with 18-year-old waitress and absolute blonde bombshell Nicole Brown.
I didn't realize, I knew she was younger, but I didn't realize it was 18 and 30. I don't know why I thought that they had gotten together when she was a little bit older. Like, that's basically criminal in itself. I can 100% see why like an 18-year-old would fall for a rich and famous 30-year-old. But like, what does a 30-year-old man have in common with an 18-year-old teenager?
I'm not sure, to be honest. And I don't know if it was just like a different time, so to speak, or if it was because of just their lifestyle, you know, kind of go off to work for a week, shoot a commercial or movie, then have all this free time. And I don't know, live more like a college kid home for the summer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But every single person who knew the couple in 1977 had said Nicole and OJ both fell fast and hard and were totally in love.
I mean, she's stunning, and they did make like a good looking couple, but ick. I'm still icked out.
They were an attractive couple. And I would say Nicole could be the poster child for like a California girl. She had this like sun-kissed skin. She had this vibrant blonde hair, and just, she was fun and bubbly. And which is funny, because Nicole wasn't even originally from California. She was born in Germany. Her father, Lou, served in World War II and met her German mother, Juditha, who went by Judy. And they married and had four daughters, Denise, Nicole, Dominique, and Tanya. And the Brown family moved to the U.S. when Denise and Nicole were young and settled in Garden Grove, California. And Garden Grove is kind of east of Huntington Beach in Orange County. So generally beachy, laid back, chill vibes.
Mm-hmm.
So Nicole attended Rancho Alamitos High School and Dana Hills High School. She graduated in 1976. And get this, she ended her senior year by quoting in her yearbook, "Be yourself. Don't be phony. You don't have to do anything."
Oh, I love that. It's like a total vibe.
Nicole was just ready to get out there and find her place in the world. And after graduating high school, she moved into a friend's studio apartment and started her job waitressing at the Daisy. So around this time is when she met OJ. And most people who've ever sat down for an interview have said he just had that kind of it factor. He had the charisma, mm-hmm. the personality. And by most accounts, Nicole and OJ were just an amazing couple, on the surface at least. And it wasn't until many years later that people closest to them and the world would learn how early the issues between them started.
Oh.
So Nicole's older sister, Denise, has shared that as early as 1977, a darker side of OJ started to show. Nicole went to watch OJ play at a home game for the Buffalo Bills, where Nicole actually kissed a friend on the cheek and OJ caught wind of it. And this incredibly innocent act, Nicole probably didn't even think twice about it, but OJ completely flipped out, like screaming at her that she embarrassed him.
Oh, God. That's like fragile masculinity, fragile ego. Like, but I can also see why Nicole might not have liked that, but like, I can also see why maybe she put up with it. He just got done playing a game. I'm sure he's hyped up. Like, I don't know if they win or lost, but if this is the first time he's kind of acted out like that, mm-hmm. and especially she's so young and so in love and, you know, she's having otherwise this great time, I'm sure that was enough to kind of distract her from the glimpses of, like, the bad behavior. And she was so young, like, she didn't know any better, I feel like. But he's 30, a grown-ass man should not be acting that way towards a partner.
This is kind of a dangerous behavior, and it's one of the things kind of at the root of this entire case. And spoiler alert, in case for those who have been under a rock for the past 100 years, OJ was, of course, found not guilty for the murders of Nicole and Ron, and ultimately the trial became about almost everything except these problems. They didn't even talk about how he treated Nicole during these 17 years together. And that's also why in this episode, we're really going to be focusing on Nicole, because everybody knows the story. There's much better versions out there than what we can produce. So watch one of those. But we're going to talk about Nicole today.
No, she and Ron are the most important people in this entire case. Like, they're the victims. I mean, along with like her children and loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we could do 6 months of coverage on this case and still not get to everything. So I love this idea. We are going to focus on Nicole.
So moving along, just before the 1978 football season, OJ was traded from the Bills to the San Francisco 49ers. And his career actually ended 1 year later in 1979 because of some knee problems. But most people remember him on the Bills. And as far as athletes go, OJ literally went out on top. He had incredible career stats, and he was loved and cherished by his country. And by this point, Nicole was living in OJ's Rockingham house and was quite literally the queen of the castle. They hosted friends, they had parties, and Nicole was just an incredible hostess. They spent a ton of time together as a family with OJ's children, Arnell and Jason. And Nicole seemed to be such a natural with kids because it was her dream to be a wife and mother.
Aww.
All right, Melissa, quick confession. I swore I would never, ever waste my time reading that book, OJ's book, if I did it. But I felt like for this episode, it was like mandatory. Have you ever read that book?
You took one for the team. Hell no. I do not want to hear his confession.
It was terrible. It was just a self-aggrandizing pile of crap. It really is bonfire kindling is what it is.
Ugh.
But by OJ's account, the time between retirement and the 1985 wedding to Nicole was fantastic, if you ask him. But he would say that Nicole would be the one nagging him about getting married and having babies and having this big happy family, and he just agreed to do it because it's what she wanted.
Oh, God. I hate when men say shit like that. Like, I gave it and married her to make her happy. Like, shut up, bro. She was way out of your league to begin with. You should have been so grateful that she even looked at you.
I feel like he wanted to turn, I don't know, this like, he wanted to make Nicole his property or like a trophy, like the Heisman, you know?
100%.
And that's the overall sense of everything that was written in this book. And I hate to reference it too much, but I do think it gives a glimpse into his overall mindset.
Yeah.
Like nothing was ever his fault. You know, like Nicole pushed his buttons. Nicole was the confrontational one. She was the insecure one. She was the jealous one. It was always something.
Well, yeah. I mean, and he's never going to take responsibility for anything. That's for clearly. Here we are, yeah. 100 years later.
Clearly.
Ugh.
The Rockingham House and his Heisman Trophy were literally his prized possessions, and everything else in life he treated like property as well. But the combination of OJ's charm and Nicole's kind of naivety and love for OJ won out. And on February 2nd, 1985, Nicole and OJ Simpson married in their Rockingham home. And this wedding was beautiful. It was big and it was attended by family and friends. Arnell, OJ's oldest daughter, said she was really happy that her dad married Nicole and that Nicole was more like a really cool big sister because they were only like 10 years apart. So they had that kind of relationship. And I'm not a math genius, but I do have children and I know how long they take to bake.
So oh my God.
They got married on February 2nd. And on October 17th of that same year, Nicole's biggest dream came true when daughter Sydney joined the family.
Oh, she was so excited for that baby. I know that. Like, that became such a huge, huge, huge part of her life.
Mm-hmm. Well, it may not have been the ultra joyous moment you believe, because controlling OJ Simpson made Nicole have a C-section delivery. Like, made her.
Wait, what? Like, he made her have major surgery to deliver their child. Why?
I have my theories. I mean, I don't claim to be an expert, but I mean, I think we can all imagine the reasons why he would do something like that.
Yeah, because he felt like Nicole and like her lady bits belonged to him. Ding, 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 ding. Yeah.
Glad you said it, not me. But that's exactly what I was thinking. And especially when you add in how incredibly despicable OJ was toward Nicole while she was pregnant. He called her all sorts of names and like degrading names and always commented on her weight when she was pregnant. And I don't know if you've ever seen any clips of Nicole in the hospital, but she looked amazing. Like, why would you bag on her?
Yeah, I've seen some pictures. Like, she looked really healthy and her face, she had that like glow. She just looked so happy. Like, she had finally gotten everything she wanted out of life, or thought she wanted out of life, I guess.
I agree.
I wonder if he did the same thing to Marguerite when she was pregnant with the first children.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Probably.
I would think so. I mean, people don't change.
A leopard doesn't change its spots.
It's true. So there are some home video clips that have been made public of a day that they were at the beach when Sydney was a little baby, and they were laying on this kind of yellow quilted blanket. And you can hear Nicole say, "Mama made this for you." And you can just tell that being a mother brought her so much joy. And while Nicole was busy growing a human in her body and preparing for a baby.
Just that.
Yeah. She was also dealing with OJ making these awful comments about her body. So, and this was behavior that would continue during her second pregnancy as well. And their son, Justin, completed the Simpson family on August 6th, 1988. So he was still pulling this stuff even when she had another kid.
He's so gross.
Well, like I said, being a mother was the highlight of Nicole's life. From the outside looking in, she had it all. And I think Nicole really did believe that she had everything, except the issues with OJ were building and escalating. And for starters, there was a lot of infidelity on OJ's part. And we all know how that, what kind of toll that takes on a relationship, even suspicions of infidelity.
Yeah.
Mike Gilbert, who was OJ's agent, also wrote a book called How I Helped OJ Get Away with Murder. And he wrote about how he would help coordinate dates with women for OJ, that the all his side pieces that he was seeing. And he would book trips and he would help hide the affairs from Nicole. Like, that was his job, was to keep things under wraps for OJ.
Do you put that on your resume? Like, side piece hider?
It's probably
the official
name.
Oh, there's more tech. Got it.
Yeah. You know how like a trash man's like a sanitation specialist manager.
Environmental services. Yes.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Well, it came out in the 1997 civil trial that OJ and actress slash model Tawny Katane had an affair during Nicole pregnancies. And my fellow old heads will remember Tawny as she was the babe on all the Whitesnake videos, climbing all over the car during Here I Go Again. And yeah. she was also, do you remember there was America's Funniest Home Videos, but there was America's Funniest People with Dave Coulier? You remember
Uncle
that
Joey?
Yeah, he had a show that was just like America's Funniest Home Videos, but just a little bit different. And Tawny Katane was his co-host. So that was in the
early 90s. I do not remember that. I'm gonna have to look it up. All right, I'm not saying that Tawny isn't beautiful, like she absolutely is, but like looking at Nicole, she's the living embodiment of a Barbie doll. She's quite possibly the most beautiful human I've ever laid my eyes on. Like, how on earth do you cheat on her?
Because men are pigs. You know, he either wasn't like mature enough to control his feelings, or he thought so little of Nicole that he used his celebrity status to have the best of both worlds.
I do wonder if men like that, and the same goes for like women, but if people like that realize that they have nothing to offer, but their bank account does, like, do they ever sit there and be like, I'm such a fucking loser. I wouldn't have any friends if I didn't have any money.
That's a good question. I'm not a rich woman, so I don't know.
Or a rich man.
I'm neither rich nor a woman. Well, during these 3 years as a young mom, Nicole had started to keep a secret journal documenting her entire private life with OJ. And she also started taking photos to document the times when OJ would get physical with her.
Honestly, like, I'm glad that she had the thought to secretly document everything, but having to do that is bad enough, and then having to like hide his awful behavior. Nobody deserves to live like that, and to have it magnified with America thinking like it's America's sweetheart, like finding out that like Shirley Temple beats puppies, like what?
And remember, OJ was so protective of this curated image that he had worked so hard to build for years, and he was just still this beloved by the country. And there had been multiple calls made to 911 by Nicole over the years, but the call on New Year's Day, 1989, was kind of the tipping point for her. Mm. And you can hear the fear in Nicole's voice on this call. And this is also the night where all the photos of Nicole's face with the marks and bruises, you've seen that photo everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's where that came from.
911 emergency.
Can you get someone over here now to 325 Gretna Green? He's back. Please.
Well, okay, what does he look like?
He's O.J. Simpson. I think you know his record. Could you just send somebody over here?
Okay, what is he doing there?
He just drove up again.
He just drove up. Okay, wait a minute. What kind of car is he in?
He's in a white Bronco, but first of all, he broke the back door down to get in.
Okay, wait a minute. What's your name?
Nicole Simpson.
Okay, is he the sportscaster or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. We're sending the police. What is he doing? Is he threatening you?
I'm going nuts.
Okay. Has he threatened you in any way, or is he just harassing you?
You're going to hear him in a minute. He's about to come in again.
Okay. Just stay on the line.
I don't want to stay on the line. I'm going to beat the shit out of
you. Wait a minute. Just stay on the line, okay? Is he upset with something that you did?
Oh, a long time ago, it always comes back.
Police found Nicole hiding outside of her home. She was half naked and just clearly scratched and bruised. And OJ was in a blind rage, screaming and yelling things like, I don't want this woman in my bed. And when the police informed OJ that he was going to be arrested, OJ hopped in his car and just drove off as fast as he could. And he was ultimately arrested and charged with spousal abuse. And being more concerned with his public image, OJ and his agents agreed it would be easier just to kind of spin the story publicly. So he pled no contest to the charges and was sentenced to, here comes your favorite part, the light sentences, 120 hours of community service, 2 years probation, and a $700 fine.
That's sick. It's almost like old Hollywood where they had the fixers who would like get rid of every scandal, like anything with like Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney. You know what I mean? Like that's exactly what this reminds me of.
It's 100% true.
And I get that this was 1989, and again, I'm so sick of hearing the times were different. Okay, so you're allowed to be shitty because you're old? Anyway. And, like, I get that he was famous, but how can it be that sentence? Like, he didn't even get, like, an anger management class or something.
It's money talks, you know? And celebrities rarely get the full smackdown as us normies get, you know?
Right.
But the whole conversation back then was different because, remember, marital rape only became illegal in all 50 states in 1993, which disgusting. I didn't know it was that. I know. And honestly, the fact that charges even stuck in 1989 is a pretty big deal. So, I mean, at least he got something.
I guess.
Well, for Nicole and OJ, it could definitely be the marker for the beginning of the end of their relationship, because this is when Nicole finally started to open up a bit to her family and friends, and even went so far as to say, OJ is going to kill me one day and he will get away with it.
How awful it must feel to think that about the person you sleep next to.
She and OJ did end up separating and did try for an additional year to make it work by kind of like, you know, couples date each other again to try to like rekindle things.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of the good times over that dating year, it wasn't working out. And the two, they knew it was finally time to end the marriage. And it kind of hit home because some of the things they were trying to do, I've been through a divorce. It's not easy. You have to kind of let go of a huge part of your life and just make new friends and find a brand new identity. It's the single version of yourself, you know, and just move on. And that's exactly what Nicole did. That's what she started doing in the summer of 1994.
Yeah, I have a few friends that have been through divorces. And like, you know, there's so many reasons why a relationship didn't work out. But I feel like most people definitely try to take the time to reconnect with themselves and like figure out life from now on.
Yeah, I feel like there's a couple ways to do it. Like a lot of people just go nuts.
Or they go crazy and go skydiving and buy a Dodge Charger.
It was a Challenger.
Oh, my bad. You just said like go crazy and I was like, oh, I know. So I'm just kidding.
We dive into my midlife crisis on another episode, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Any listeners who want to know more information, just hit me up. I got you.
Oh, my God. Point being, Nicole was doing it right. Like, she was finding her new self, you know? She was, that's the way you're supposed to do it. Because what did you say last week? You can't love other people until you love yourself.
So. I'm so wise.
Wise ass. Well, I told you that I read both If I Did It and How I Helped OJ Get Away with Murder. And both of these books do detail kind of how the night of Nicole's murder may have played out, along with what we know from police records and evidence. So Nicole and OJ's daughter, Sydney, she had a dance recital that night, and the Brown family and OJ both attended. And OJ says he slipped out before Sydney went on so he could buy her a bouquet of flowers to give her after the show. So good dad move so far. Denise recalls OJ making a point to tell her he was going to Chicago that night, which she found a little weird because he never really shared that kind of information with her normally. It wasn't like his standard MO to kind of tell her where he was going.
Oh, almost like he was creating an alibi? What?
You said it, not me. Following the performance, the Brown family took the children to dinner at Mezzaluna, and OJ was not invited to join the family dinner, which kind of offended him. And Nicole kept an eye out the window of Mezzaluna and pointing out to her sisters that OJ kept driving by. And she told her sisters, like, this was something he did. Like, he clearly did not trust her ever.
That's so creepy. Like, stalker vibes, because, like, your daughter's the star of the show tonight and it's not you. And, like, why would you want to go to dinner with, like, your soon-to-be ex-mother-in-law and your, like, what?
He definitely took that lack of an invitation as a slight or as a sign that Nicole was really just like trying to move on. It was like a big slap in the face, which you don't do that to OJ.
Yeah, he could have used a couple slaps.
Yeah. Once dinner was done and the family was heading home, Judy, Nicole's mom, was more quiet than normal. And she finally mentioned that she had lost her glasses and feared that she had left them back at Mezzaluna. So the family touched base with the restaurant and the staff kind of went around to look and they found her glasses outside. And this is when Ron Goldman, who was a waiter at Mezzaluna and kind of a newer friend of Nicole, she had met him just from going to the restaurant. Ron said he would drop them off at Nicole's on his way home. So the staff put the glasses in an envelope to keep them safe so that Ron could take them back. Here is where the actual events, quote unquote, gets a little murky, because I honestly believe the truth lies in OJ's most recent words from If I Did It. And so this is kind of my interpretation of the case based on those words.
Got it.
So something set OJ off that night, and he decided he needed to go set things straight with Nicole. His words were, quote, he wanted to scare her straight, end quote. But whatever it was, he drove from his Rockingham house to her home on Bundy, which is about 2 miles apart. So it took him about 8 minutes to drive there. And he had a ski cap. He had gloves. He had a knife.
Oh, yeah, that's just to scare her. Okay.
So those closest to Nicole actually knew that she had a latch on her back gate that didn't work. So OJ was able to access the gate without alerting her that he was there. He's creeping around the house, and Nicole had candles lit, and there was music playing, and the bathtub upstairs was like full and ready to go. And for like from the outside looking in, it would have been easy to assume that Nicole was preparing for company, so to speak. But there's also a possibility that she was literally just treating herself to a nice hot tub, like unwind from the day.
We talked so much about inferiority last week. OJ, like this soft, fragile little ego, he is so insecure.
Regardless of how he was interpreting that scene, he crept through the back gate and got himself into a rage, like flew off the handle. And at this point, Ron, who was friends with Nicole, came in through the back and surprised OJ. And OJ probably assumed he was there to see or more likely sleep with Nicole. And so he sent him into like a different level. Like he just absolutely snapped. And no one ever will know the truth at this point. But we do know that Nicole and Ron were both stabbed multiple times. And Nicole had her throat slit almost to the point of decapitation. It was horrible, horrific. And so either OJ really didn't care, or OJ was under the assumption that his children weren't home with Nicole because he fled the scene, leaving
a
mix of.
He didn't care.
I agree. I don't think he knew if they were there or not. But he left a mix of blood from Nicole, Ron, and himself in the infamous white Bronco.
I don't really think he gave a shit if his kids were there or not. I think that he had gotten himself into a tizzy. He made up a situation that didn't exist. He blew it way out of proportion, and he lost his shit. I feel like his kids could have been standing there and he wouldn't have cared. He cares about one person, and that's himself.
Yeah, and I mean, clearly he went over there with a plan, and I don't think it was to scare her.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty safe to say, I mean, most of us have seen the crime scene photos, and Savage doesn't even begin to describe it. I mean, it was one of the first set of real crime scene photos I'd ever seen, to be honest with you. And in the book, How I Helped OJ Get Away with Murder, Mike says he thinks there could have been a conversation or a call between OJ and Nicole before OJ went to her house. And maybe she said like the kids were staying at her parents or something. So that maybe answers the kid thing, you know, like if OJ knew the kids were there or not.
Oh, but they were there. So do you think she maybe said that to keep him from trying to come over to quote unquote see, like using, like seeing that as an excuse?
Possibly. Whatever was going through his mind regarding his kids, OJ left Nicole's. He parked the Bronco on a side street of his house, and he snuck into his own property because the limo driver was already at his house waiting to take him to the airport for his flight to Chicago. Remember that alibi he created? I'm going to Chicago.
Yep.
So OJ rushed around, he changed and gathered all of his bags, and he heads in the limo and goes to the airport. And that night he had actually a new driver. So the driver couldn't say if OJ was acting normal or not because he didn't really know him, you know his personality. But he did mention that OJ was very adamant about handling a black duffel bag, that he kind of kept it with him at all times, like wouldn't let the driver touch it, put it in the trunk. He kept it with him the whole way to the airport. And that bag has never been seen again. OJ actually got through the airport and went off to Chicago.
That's wild. He just seems so like disassociated with what he just did and just like, okay, get on a plane, go to Chicago next.
Well, this was all part of the story, I think. So I think it's one of the multiple reasons why America ended up so divided about his guilt. You know, it was like a lot of other notable killers that we've talked about where he was kind of able to compartmentalize what he did. And he created the person that everybody wanted to see.
Well, he's an actor, too. Did we all forget that?
You have to watch Naked Gun too. He's hilarious. So for the sake of time, and since it's well beyond documented as to what happens, like literally the whole world knows, OJ came back from Chicago and he insisted on talking to the police. And in a very odd interview, it was pretty much he was the only suspect from the start. I mean, obviously. And it wasn't until after Nicole's funeral that the police would let OJ know that he's going to be charged with the murders of Nicole and Ron. And that's what led to that infamous Bronco chase, that the very low speed chase down I-405. And it was a seemingly suicidal OJ was supposed to surrender to the police, but instead he slipped out of the house with his best friend, Al A.C. Cowlings, and Al was driving. And they left police with no idea of where they were. And a friend and lawyer, Robert Kardashian, went on live TV to read a suicide note that OJ had left behind.
This letter was written by OJ today. To whom it may concern. First, everyone understand I had nothing to do with Nicole's murder. I loved her, always have, and always will. If we had a problem, it's because I loved her so much. I think of my life and feel I've done most of the right things. So why do I end up like this? I can't go on. No matter what the outcome, people will look and point. I can't take that. I can't subject my children to that. This way, they can move on and go on with their lives. Please, if I've done anything worthwhile in my life, let my kids live in peace from you, the press.
This might be an unpopular opinion, but again, with everything that's come out about OJ over the last 30 years, I think this whole thing might have been his best acting role to date. Like, I don't buy that he was suicidal. You know, to put on this big show and about how much he loved Nicole and how he just wanted to be with her. He already had, like, his legal team on speed dial. They knew how to get the public on their side if they were going to have a chance in court. Like, they knew at this point, shit, this is not going to go away. We got to do something to spin the narrative.
I don't know. I've seen a lot in 20-some years as in TV, but, like, this was gold. Where have you ever seen a high-profile celebrity getting charged with murder and fleeing from the police on live TV? It was insane. And once the Bronco was located by a local helicopter crew, it was an hour and a half of just people were glued to their sets. It was a circus. And they were taking over broadcasts. I mentioned earlier the NBA Finals. It literally cut off the finals to go to this chase. And LA locals were coming out in droves. They were like lining the overpasses and the streets holding signs like, "We love the juice, run juice," and "OJ, run OJ, run." And they're also in signs of support. And in one of the books, what I read that OJ himself was shocked at how fast people got out there to be a part of this, like, messed up story in some form.
All right. A couple things. Clearly, people are always going to be shitty because, like, look at everyone's love and fascination of Luigi guy who killed the, you know. And I mean, look at all the support Ted Bundy got because he was good looking, etc. So that's never going to change.
Yep.
But do you realize, like, what you just said about how OJ was shocked at how fast people got there to be a part of it? He's still thinking about him.
Right.
He's not thinking about, I just killed the mother of my children. He's thinking about, look at all these people here to see me.
I could not agree more. And I think I was 13 at the time. And I vividly remember this chase because it was not a typical high speed chase. They were driving completely normal. It was like watching this car doing the speed limit, but being chased by this like flying V of police cars. It was just so odd.
He's such a loser. He couldn't even be in a cool high speed chase. Like, you friggin' tool. What an idiot.
He set the cruise control to like 45 and was just like, Well, this media circus would only get worse, though. And honestly, it's really sad because The trial against O.J. started on January 24th, 1995, and it lasted a staggering 8 months. And O.J. had compiled this super team of lawyers. They were 11 lawyers dubbed the Dream Team, led by Robert Shapiro. And you had Johnny Cochran, Robert Kardashian, F. Lee Bailey, and Alan Dershowitz. I mean, you're not losing that case.
No.
With that lineup. And Johnny Cochran ended up taking the lead during the trial. And I'm not going to sugarcoat anything here, because the LAPD had a pretty gross history when it came to racism and profiling in the Black community in L.A. If you remember, 1991, Rodney King, his name still comes up today. Mm-hmm. He was brutally beaten by white officers, and the attack on King was filmed by a local neighbor who sent the footage to all the local news stations. This huge story broke, and the officers involved were found not guilty during state trials against them, and this caused a complete uproar in LA.
Understandably so.
Yeah, seriously, like racial tensions were at an all-time high, and people exploded, and they took to the streets, and it led to the 1992 riots. So this is on the heels of that. Fast forward a year and a half later, and the LA community was by no means healed. Johnny Cochran had leaned on those hard racial tensions that entire time, too, because here he was, a prominent Black attorney, and he was defending a beloved Black athlete against murdering two white people.
I get that defense attorneys get paid a lot of money to do exactly what they did, but it's just crazy. Like, how was he able to push the race narrative so hard? Like, how did he make that relevant to a murder charge?
Yeah. And I mean, you can honestly thank a detective named Mark Furman for this, because when you really dissect the case, unfortunately, you can say Detective Furman is probably the real reason why they lost the case for the prosecution. And Furman was one of the detectives that had first responded to Nicole's home on the night of the murders. And he was credited as the one who found that bloody glove. If the glove don't fit, you must acquit.
Mm-hmm.
And there really isn't any evidence to say he did bad police work that night, as his work should have been kind of a big win in terms of the evidence that the state was using. But a huge mistake on Furman's part came during... opened the door for the Dream Team. So under oath, Furman testified that he had never, ever used a racial slur towards or when talking about Black people. So the Dream Team was actually able to produce a recording. It was an audio tape of Furman kind of using that derogatory language that he said he didn't use. And essentially this perjured himself, and it made everything that he said from that point forward kind of uncredible. And the defense even went so far as to say Furman planted evidence against OJ due to his being a racist.
Well, that guy is a shitbag for lying, and he's a shitbag for using that language. So his credibility is shot. I mean, he comes across as a racist. He's clearly a liar. So way to go, Furman. Let's also not forget that I think that the LAPD certainly wasn't doing that great of a job, especially in the 70s, 80s, 90s. So I can fully understand, like, hating on the LAPD for their horrific racist views, but also because they sucked at what they did. But again, this is about the murder of two people.
And that's the kind of the general consensus when looking back at and really studying the way the case unfolded. You know, there were obviously a lot of factors at play. And I think the one that is often overlooked is that the jury, all of them, basically including the alternates, were sequestered for the full length of the trial, which ended up being 265 days. Jeez. Like, think about a jury. Like, we talk about trials going a week, 2 weeks. This was almost a full year. You know, it's a long time. It's a long time for anyone to basically be locked up themselves away from their families, their jobs, their lives. So,
my God, there'd be another trial, because I would kill somebody if I got stuck with them for that long.
I agree. You couldn't even be away from your dogs for that long.
Oh, my God. No, nope. I'd be like, throw me in the slammer, but let me take them with me.
Well, after the jury came back, it only took them 4 hours to deliberate before they made up their minds. And on October 3rd, 1995, Orenthal James Simpson, to the shock of many, including his own lawyer and friend, Robert Kardashian, was found not guilty. and by the end of the day was back in his beloved Rockingham home. Isn't that nuts?
Yeah, and I've seen the clip of Robert Kardashian's face when the verdict was read. Like, it honestly says it all. Even he's like, holy shit, what? Like, yeah. He's like completely shocked. Like, I feel like he pinches himself to like make sure that really happened.
I don't keep up with the Kardashians, but I think you're right. And maybe his reaction had something to do with the outcome a year later when the Brown family and the Goldman family sued OJ in a wrongful death civil suit, mm-hmm. in which OJ was found guilty and liable for the deaths of Nicole and Ron. And that case awarded $33.5 million to the families, but of course, no payments from OJ.
That's so gross. Like, I wish that there had been some way for that to have been enforceable. I don't understand why it's not, even if they just got a little bit. Like, obviously, money isn't going to bring Nicole or Ron back. It's not going to get rid of your pain. It's not going to do any of that. But it could have been put to good use by the families, I'm sure. Better use than whatever his dumbass was doing with it. I hate him.
I know. And I remember being in English class when the school televised the verdict. I mean, they knew the verdict was coming down and they put it on. And I just remember confusion. I was so young and didn't have, obviously, I come from a small town, predominantly white. So we were all confused, but I know that Black communities had celebrated. And I'm not sure if, I don't know, you know, I don't know if they really believed he was innocent or if they just wanted to see something good happen to a Black man in LA.
And that's fair, but it sucks that, like, because LAPD effed up just in general for decades as bad as they did or have, so much shit went so wrong.
It did. And honestly, without any settlement money, Nicole and Ron's sisters have really dedicated their lives since the mid-90s to helping others. So something good did come out of this eventually. I'm sure it took a lot of healing. And I want to start with Kimberly Goldman, who is Ron's sister, because every time a new documentary comes out, I feel like she doesn't really want to do it, but mm-hmm. does it because she loved her brother. And I run into that too, where it's like a case has been done 4 or 5 times. They've got media fatigue. They're burned out. But they're like, if you're going to tell this story, I want to be involved in it, because otherwise you can say whatever you want.
Yeah, you're their voice.
Yeah, exactly right. So today, Kimberly is the co-chair of the National Center for Victims of Crime. And it's a nonprofit that advocates for victims' rights, helps train professionals, and works with victims. And it's also a very trusted, reliable source for information if anyone needs any. And she's also the executive director for the Youth Project and worked on the early stages to help develop the National Compassion Fund.
Wow.
And she's an accomplished author. And in 2019, she actually launched her own podcast called Confronting OJ. But I think the biggest tribute to Ron is in the fact that Kim, in spite of all the kind of pain and grief, she continued to live just a beautiful life. She found love and created a family. So good for her.
What a badass. That's awesome.
Yeah. And Nicole's sisters, they've also been busy over the years. So each mm-hmm. sister shared kind of a special and unique bond with Nicole in their own way. And last year, the sisters came together to release a new documentary, The Life and Murder of Nicole Brown Simpson. And for the last 30 years, Nicole's life and death has been overshadowed so much by O.J. Simpson
because of
the salacious nature of the murder. You know, everybody wants to know, did he really do it?
Mm-hmm.
And the sisters truly wanted to celebrate Nicole's life and provide a personal view of who she was as a person. So Denise and Dominique and Tanya have all had time to like process their grief and anger along with the love of Nicole and Nicole's children. And over the years have all found ways to use their voice to kind of bring attention to domestic violence.
I love how much like all of these sisters like love their siblings and just want to keep Nicole and Ron's name and memories alive. I have a little brother and I don't know what I would do if I was in their position, because I'm a very vengeful person. So it would take me a while to get beyond the anger I would feel. But like to hear that they've all found such beautiful ways to honor their siblings and help other people in the process it always amazes me how good things happen out of these horrific tragedies.
I feel like they have to. And I don't know. It's the only way I feel like you can move on is to find that, find a new passion and find a way to turn that into something positive that would honor their memory. Yeah. And I don't know. But you're absolutely right. Like, that sibling bond is no joke. And guys, I know we gave you kind of a not a very high level retelling of this case. And there's a reason, because whenever a new documentary comes out, they're always like 4 to 8 hours long because there's so much to cover. There's truly just so many people and points of views and just years of bad behavior to examine and complex social problems regarding how we view domestic violence and all the racial tension. So this is obviously an hour long look at the case that we could never do justice to the true story. And the sad truth is that the lives of both Nicole and Ron were both overshadowed.
Well, I mean, that's sadly something we have always seen. Like, everyone can name Ted Bundy, but can you name five of his victims? And that sucks.
It's why there's a billion true crime shows, and people eat it up. They love it.
Well, and that's why I think it's so important that we do victimology and we talk about the victim and what they liked, what was their favorite color, like, because they're the reason we're doing this story.
Mm-hmm. They're the reason we do all our stories.
Yeah. Well, that was quite a case to take on, but you did it. And a huge thank you to our girl, Sue Van Valkenburg Grace, one of our research producers. She helped put this one together while Ed was traveling for work.
Absolutely. Sue did an awesome job, as always. That's why we brought her on, right?
Duh.
I feel like now would be a good time to also mention why we chose OJ to focus on this week. And because obviously it's a case that everybody has heard 20 different versions of, you know, and what they haven't heard is a truly personal perspective that into that sibling bond that you were just talking about. And it's the bond that existed between the Brown sisters. So we thought we'd have Tanya Brown on next week to talk about her remarkable sister, Nicole. And not the usual stories, though, that you hear on all these docs. Not the she was a good mom and she was just fun to be around. Like, we're talking like the crazy memories they made when they'd go out for a night on the town, or the first time she saw fear in Nicole's eyes as she sat on the corner of OJ's bed. And most importantly, how they were all lost behind the veil of this like high profile hoopla. They were forced to grieve this murder during an absolute media circus. So we'll talk about how that felt to have to go through something like this in front of the whole world. So get excited, because there should be some pretty personal stories that about Nicole Brown Simpson that have never been heard.
Yeah, I'm really excited to just hear about her, like, as a person, like BO before OJ. Anyway, listeners, if you have any questions for Tanya, shoot them our way, and tell us your thoughts about OJ. And if you think he's innocent, tell us why. Please enlighten us.
Dying to hear.
But you can do that on our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok. You can shoot us a line on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. Or you can shoot us an email to murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Oh, and if any one of our like little crime crew peeps wants to send in their listener suggestions for a case, we will be doing listener suggestions in April. So send them our way. And while you're shooting us a line, take like 5 seconds and like, review, subscribe. Whatever you got to do, just do all the things.
I think it's under 5 seconds, like a click. How much is a mouse? 0.5 seconds, I think it takes.
Click. I've never timed it. I'm going to time
that's it.
Yep. And we're still sending out stickers for anybody who does that stuff. Just shoot us a screenshot, and we will send you a super fun sticker.
Understatement. Sick new stickers.
Ed hasn't even seen them, but he hasn't seen like the actual sticker yet. So
I'll put a picture up.
Yes, they are pretty sick, and they're even going to be cut correctly.
Doubtful. So,
yeah, don't hold your breath. But with that, we hope everybody has a good night. Thank you for listening. Be kind. Don't be a dick. And remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
They do wear Buffalo Bills jerseys sometimes.
They wear football jerseys.
Pretty good. Well, then we're on the same wavelength about pervs and what they wear.
Get out of my brain.
Make me.
Bye.